Welcome to Inclusion Solution Live. I am so excited to share this series with you called Justice for All, which celebrates the Winters Group 40th anniversary of fighting for equity and justice in the workplace. I am ecstatic to welcome Dr. Ruha Benjamin as our guest today. She really needs no introduction for many of us who know her work in the area of equity and justice, particularly as it relates to technology. She's an enthralling storyteller, a brilliant scholar, and fierce advocate for all things just. Dr. Benjamin is a professor of African American studies at Princeton University, where she studies the social dimensions of science, medicine, and technology with a focus on the relationship between innovation and inequity, knowledge and power, race and citizenship, and health and justice. As a founding director of the Ida B. Wells Just Data Lab, she brings together students, educators, activists, and artists to rethink and retool data for justice. Dr. Benjamin is the author of Race After Technology, Abolitionist Tools for the New Jim Code, editor of Captivating Technology, and she recently released her fourth book, winner of the 2023 Stowe Prize, Viral Justice, How We Grow the World We Want, born out of the twin plagues of COVID-19 and police violence. At the center of Dr. Benjamin's work is the invitation to imagine and craft the worlds we cannot live without, just as we dismantle the ones we cannot live within. Welcome, 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 Dr. Ruha Benjamin.
Thank you for having me. It's such an honor to be in conversation with you. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would love our listeners to hear more about you, your background, your parents, where you grew up, your education. I mean, I've read all about this, but I just think you just have such a fascinating background that brought you to the work that you're doing today around, you know, innovation and equity and the tensions there.
Absolutely. So my shorthand for my biography is to say that I come from many Souths, because it seems like most of the places where I've lived and grown up has been the South of somewhere. And so I was born in India to a mother of Iranian descent, she was born and raised in India. My dad is African American, and they met in the 70s, and they got married the day after they met, which is a story all its own that we might go into. And then I moved, we all moved in with my grandmother in South LA. Then we moved to South Carolina when I was five. And then I went to boarding school for 2 years in high school in Southern Africa, in what was then called Swaziland.
Oh.
And
yeah.
Then I went to college at Spelman in Southwest Atlanta. And then I went to graduate school at UC Berkeley in California, and a few other stops to before I got to Princeton, New Jersey. And so the reason I say South is not just geographically, but this idea that being under or lower or looking at the world from its underbelly, looking up at the world and thinking about how all of the things, many of the things that we associate with progress and innovation and moving forward, looking at the underbelly, who's excluded, who's left out, who's trampled over in the process. And so that South perspective is also about looking at things from beneath, from below, and bringing that perspective into my work as well.
Wow, yeah, Swaziland. I've actually been to Swaziland, but it's no longer Swaziland,
no,
right?
Eswatini.
Yeah. And is it still King Mutswati?
I think so. The last I checked, could be wrong.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so the South, yeah, absolutely. And looking at the world from the underbelly and being underneath. You studied in South Africa as well, did you not?
Yeah, well, Swaziland, when I was in boarding school, so Swaziland is
interior.
So it's bordered by South Africa,
right,
on three sides. And so instead of coming home for those holidays, because it was such a long trip, I would travel around South Africa and neighboring countries with friends And so I didn't study there, but I spent a lot of time there.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So we have another thing in common. My daughter, who's president of the Winters Group, also is a Spelman graduate.
Wow. There we go.
Were you there when Dr. Cole was there?
I came the year she left. So I had one conversation with her. So we kind of crossed in the night. And so I was there when Dr. Beverly Tatum was president.
Okay. So, yeah. So was my daughter. So you probably crossed paths there somehow. The reason I mentioned Dr. Cole, Dr. Janetta Cole, is that she's also going to be a keynote speaker at the conference.
Well, I wish it was in person.
Yes, I know. Next time. Yes. Yeah. So let's talk about your work, you know, just sort of generally tell me, you know, about your work, you know, the tensions that you talk about in your writing between innovation and equality and equity. What are some of those tensions? There are so many, right?
Yes.
So, but what are them for us?
Like, do we have a half a day?
I
think it's good to know that. So I was trained as a sociologist. Mm-hmm. I went at Spelman, I studied sociology and anthropology. And then at Berkeley, I studied sociology. And within the field of sociology, my specialty is looking at the social dimensions of science, technology, and medicine. Mm-hmm. And so when I first started out as a grad student, my focus was on biotechnologies. And at the time, living in California, the state was pouring billions of dollars into regenerative medicine, stem cell therapies, and mm-hmm. offering it as a kind of the future of mm-hmm. medicine. Mm-hmm. And so part of, again, looking at it from the underside is to think about, okay, let's look at the promise of this field. Let's look at what they hope to do. But what are some of the things that they're not paying attention to? The people, the mm-hmm. communities who, for example, might be, as we've seen historically, asked to be part of the clinical trials for this medicine, but then don't have access to the actual treatments when they come out. Mm. And this is innovation and inequity is like, okay, you need us and you need our bodies to develop this field, but mm. you're not putting in place any measures that will guarantee those same communities are going to be able to benefit once they're actually honed and developed. And right. so that's one example of mm-hmm. a tension where we're doing really far out, far fetched, mm-hmm. and what you might say things when it comes to biotechnology, growing human cells in a petri dish, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. that you can, instead of needing a transplant, you can go and take some of your own cells and right. they can reverse engineer and grow organs that are tailor made for you, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. so that is like, we're talking about Star Trek level, like, you know, amazing things. And yet at the same time that people are working on this, they refuse to guarantee that that the public coffers in California will ensure healthcare for all. The very same ballot measure that I was studying, where California voters were voting up stem cell research and saying, yes, let's invest mm-hmm. $3 billion into this field. That very same ballot measure had a different proposition that would have extended healthcare to more workers in the state, and that was voted down. And mm-hmm. so here we can invest in the future of medicine, but not what we need right here and right now. Right. And so that imbalance of mm-hmm. thinking about where we're investing and who is going to benefit, that's like a starting point for me that then trickles to so many different areas. I'll give one more example. Before we move on, like thinking about beyond the benefit for these fields, we know that with tech booms, and again, now it's not just Silicon Valley, there's so many regions of the world that are marketing themselves as like the next Silicon Valley, right? Mm-hmm. Atlanta calls itself Silicon Peach. Mm-hmm. Nairobi, Kenya calls itself Silicon Savannah, right? So there's all of these efforts to be like a tech hub. But what we know is that with the growth of the tech industry in all of these places, inequities have grown more stark. So that in Palo Alto at one point, 1 in 3 school children were experiencing housing insecurity because housing prices were going up and it was really catering to those who could pay cash, you know, for new properties. And so just as you have this growth in innovation and technology, the investments in our social well-being and our social safety net have gone down. And it's not like we have, it has to be either or, but we have a displaced priorities when it comes to who's going to benefit from this progress.
Right. Yeah. And that's what justice is really all about, right? Looking at who's benefiting, right? Who's being harmed.
Yes. Questions. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah. And those are the questions that, oftentimes in a capitalistic world, they don't want to talk about, right?
No. Right. No. Yeah. They skip over, to the bottom line. And so this is what we have to push back on and really talk about how, if anyone's being left behind, then we can't call it progress.
Yeah, exactly. And we're seeing a lot of that, today. So how are these tensions, so in the post, George Floyd era, I would say, so our business, I've been in business now almost 40 years. And, we saw this big, burst of new business because everybody said, oh, we're now going to be focused on, racial injustice, because we didn't know. We didn't know that we still had racism in the world. Right. That's what they were saying. And now that we know, we're going to put these commitments. And so all these statements came out. And as you well know, everybody's rolling back now. So, when you think about your work relative, to technology, yeah, and racism in algorithm, just the whole area of, all of this injustice, yeah, that comes. How does this play out today, yeah, as opposed to even like 3 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is when you make changes like we saw in 2020 that are more about marketing and more about looking good, mm-hmm, and sort of reputation washing.
Yeah. Performative, right? Yeah.
And we can pretty much guarantee that's going to be short-lived. That, mm-hmm, is, as soon as you feel like you no longer have to do that marketing, or that marketing becomes a liability, like in the current era where there are all these attacks against people, talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, then we can expect the rollbacks. And so part of, the way that my work enters that phenomenon is to say that justice work is not charity work. It's not work that one group or one business is doing for other people. We have to understand, and it takes some work to do, that these kind of changes benefit not just the have-nots, but the haves. And so, exactly, once you realize that you are not doing something for another group, it's going to benefit you too in various ways. When we strengthen the social safety net, and when we stop pouring billions of dollars into carceral technologies and tools and policing, and actually deal with the root causes of problems, whether it's mental health and housing and healthcare, all of these areas, education that we can strengthen and invest in, then it's not just going to benefit the people that are directly affected, but it's everyone who now gets to live in a more socially connected, safe, loving world. And so part of it, from companies and organizations' point of view, unless you have really grappled with how the kinds of policy and practical changes you're making are in your best interest, not for one group or another, then it's always going to be fickle. It's always going to rise and, come and go based on trends, based on what the public discourse is at, at a particular time. And so this is an invitation for more deeper reflection on, why are you doing or standing for certain things? Is it to look good in any given political climate? Or is it because you understand that you, your employees, the communities that you purport to serve are actually going to benefit from these in the long term?
Right. Yeah, it's kind of the proposition that Heather McGee makes in The Sum of Us, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly that.
Yes. But so let's talk specifically about bias in, in technology that you so beautifully write about. There's so many examples. I was rereading, re-listening to actually, Race for Technology, because I had read it, a couple of years ago. So now let me go back. I'm going to be talking with her today. But so let's just specifically as it relates to the workplace, because our work is primarily in the corporate world. We support, large organizations with DEI work. And it would be interesting to hear your perspective on what you're seeing relative to workplace
issues.
Absolutely.
And so in some ways, you know, what's happening with technology in the workplace, there's a lot of corollaries in other areas in which mm-hmm. technologies are being introduced, partly because people are sort of accepting the fact that humans are biased, that we sort of have favoritism for in-group and we discriminate against out-groups. And so in some ways, the turn to technology, it grows out of an acceptance that human beings are flawed. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem lies in the fact that you assume technology grows on trees and is not influenced by those very same human beings, right? So let's take a workplace context where, let's say, a particular company for the last 30 years has a really poor track record of attracting diverse talent. Let's mm-hmm. say, whether it's gender, whether it's race, ethnicity. So let's say the hiring rate of different groups is pretty low and it's more homogenous, especially when you start looking at leadership, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now that the data from that, those three decades, that's the starting point to train a technical system to help you make decisions going forward. That's the inputs mm-hmm. for teaching an algorithm how to decide who you want to hire in the future. So the algorithm is going to learn, well, based on what you've been doing, you really prefer men. You really prefer people who are white or English speaking or a whole host of other factors. So that data, what you have been doing in the analog world, is used and you to train these technical systems to then home in on the very same demographics. But now the danger is because you're using a technology, you assume that it's unbiased, you assume it's objective, you assume it's neutral, when in fact, it's just reproducing the status quo and putting it in this veneer of technological progress. And so partly what we want to do when we look at technology is to ask ourselves, what are the existing patterns mm-hmm. of discrimination and bias that are being built into these systems? How can we, before we deploy them and implement them in the workplace, how can we actually reckon with that history of a given company or industry mm-hmm. so that we don't replicate the problem, so that we build technologies that are actually counteracting the problem rather than just hiding the problem of discrimination in the workplace? So this is one example where hiring algorithms are being used in hundreds and hundreds of companies and organizations, assuming that they're better than humans, when they're basically, you can think of them like our little offspring, right? Our little children, where if you have children, you know that they do as you do, not what you say. And so it's learning from us and just reproducing it. And the same way as it comes to learning about race and inequality in our school systems, ignoring the problem doesn't make it go away. That is, kids, this is, you know, based on mm-hmm. on research looking at how young people learn about race, when their parents don't talk to them and help them process the world,
right,
they reproduce it. They right. assume, well, okay, talking about the doll test, for example, mm-hmm. that's been replicated, like they're gonna look around and see who's valued. Oh, lighter skin is right. prettier, smarter, et cetera, darker skin. You don't have to tell them anything. They're just looking and processing the world. Same with our technologies. They're learning from us and they reproduce it like our little offspring. And so if we want to, same way we want to train our children better, we want to train our technologies better in order to understand that these are not right, they're not good, and that we can see and discern these social categories with more equity and justice in mind.
So how do you do that? And what is the incentive for organizations to actually take this step?
Yeah. And so again, thinking about what you have to gain, I mean, partly we have to start from the assumption that talent and excellence is, we can find it everywhere. In every group, it's not a monopolized by a certain mm-hmm. demographic. And so part of the incentive is that you want to be able to attract and tap that talent and that excellence that's everywhere, right? And so we know based on research, you know, coming out of business schools, that more diverse teams, because you have people looking at issues from different angles and thinking about bringing their experiences and their insights to the table, that oftentimes those teams do much better in terms of whatever their product development. A really concrete example for you, a few years ago, Google was coming out with its latest phone and wanted to use the face recognition so people could open the phones with their face data. And at the same time that they were developing this, they were paying attention to this research that showed that facial recognition technology doesn't work as well on people with darker skin. Mm-hmm. And so they said, well, we want our product to work on everyone. If it only works on one demographic, that limits your market, right? And so they're like, well, we want everyone to be able to use this product. We want a more inclusive product. Even just thinking about it from the point of view of like the bottom line, not even the ethics or the ethos, just saying, we want more customers. And so if people are having a hard time using it, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So in this case, they wanted to remember that training data that we talked about to teach this system how to recognize a whole spectrum of types. They said, well, our training data is mostly white faces. And so that's why we're having this problem. It's learning to discern differences on what my colleague Joy Bulamwini calls pale male faces. And so if we wanted to work on others, they wanted to diversify their training data. Now, here's the thing. How are they going to do that? What they decided to do was to hire contract workers in places like Atlanta and Los Angeles with a high density of Black folks. And the contract workers were instructed to approach people, Black folks, but specifically people who were housed, they were homeless, right? And said, play with this phone. Here's a $5 gift card. We're going to get, we're going to take a picture of you. But don't tell them what that picture is for. Don't tell them what they were being involved in. And so specifically that withholding of information was a red flag for contract workers. They said, wait a minute, if this is so good, why are we being asked not to tell people what it's for? And moreover, why are we being told to approach really vulnerable populations if this is a kosher sort of situation? So they blew the whistle, went to the media. And so when I was thinking about this whole scenario, going back to what's in the best interest of the company, I was thinking about who was around that table when this was decided, because this eventually backfired on Google, right? They got really bad press, bad PR, all of that, because it was seen as exploitative, right?
Right.
So I was thinking, who's around that table? Who, based on race, ethnicity, based on ordinary background, like you could imagine someone sitting around that table at Google who had taken a class in the history of science and medicine and knew about this track record of using vulnerable populations for scientific experimentation. Maybe they would have raised their hand and said, this is not going to look good. So based on what has happened in the past, the fact that we're approaching people who are vulnerable and withholding information, this is going to backfire on us. Maybe you had some Black folks around the table that have a rightful skepticism towards medicine and science because of this history. They might have said, we need to find a different way to train this data, not do it like this. And so again, that's diversity of discipline and thought, diversity of experience that would have been valuable to the company to avoid this terrible, the series of events that ended up backfiring on them. But you could also imagine that diversity being there and the higher ups not listening.
Exactly. Right? Yes.
And
yes.
So you can have diversity, but if you don't understand that it's actually a resource, like it's actually something that's not cosmetic. It's not about what's on your website to make your company look diverse. It's about that diversity representing forms of knowledge that you need to actually elicit and help guide the process. Right. So you can have all the diversity you want. But if that person had raised their hand and said, you know what, this seems a little fishy, this is going to backfire. And let's say the project leader was like, oh, here goes Ruha talking about race again. Here goes Mary Frances playing the race card. Like you can have diversity, but that can be squashed. Those insights can be seen as a problem rather than as something that is actually valuable to the bottom line and to the whole process. And I imagine, like, when we think about diversity, we really have to move beyond the kind of feel good, cosmetic, this makes us look good, to what forms of knowledge and experience does this diversity give us insight to that we can actually incorporate, can help guide our process of product development that actually will benefit us along with the customers that we're seeking to serve.
So we've been making that case for a while. You know, we call it the business case for diversity.
Yes, exactly.
And it doesn't seem to be compelling enough to change the trajectory. So even though I think theoretically and philosophically people get in the abstract that this makes sense.
Yes.
It doesn't really change the representation. So in the 40 years that I've been doing this work, I would say the representation of people of color in high leadership roles hasn't really changed.
No.
We know STEM positions, right? My daughter actually is an electrical engineer. She did the program with Georgia Tech, Spelman and Georgia Tech.
Yeah, I do know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, but she's not in engineering anymore because she had such a horrible experience as a Black woman in engineering.
Yeah.
So I think that, even so, we can make all these arguments about why this is good for the world, but it's not happening. So talk about that. Why is it not happening?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, obviously, I have educated guesses, but I don't know for sure. And I'm sure there are researchers who are actually asking this question and can provide us with insights based on more empirical evaluation. But part of what, as an educator, my sense is that the problem and therefore the solution has to start much earlier than we currently do. That is trying to make the business case once organizations have their thing already set up. Part of it is thinking about the hubris, the sense of we know it all. We don't need the knowledge that you say we do.
Right.
That starts much earlier. You see that already in like undergrad, before people even enter these companies and these industries, the kind of know-it-all ethos that especially you're in STEM fields, you look at these more humanistic and social scientific insights with a little disdain. Like we even call it soft sciences versus hard sciences. Mm-hmm. Just that language tells you if you're in the hard sciences, we don't really need to learn anything from you.
So if
already in the training of the next generation of technologists, there's a sense of hubris and a sense that, when what they really need is, and we see this, applied in the context of medicine, is humility, whether cultural humility or otherwise, so that you know what you don't know. Like you have to listen for and elicit the kinds of insights and knowledge that you and I are talking about. But if you are going into this already with the kind of, like even in these companies that have a resident sociologist or ethicist or philosopher, those people are very marginal. They're they're what they have to bring is considered like icing, not essential.
Not essential, right. Yeah.
And it's the hierarchies of knowledge that begin well before you get to the context of business in the way that we train young people to think about what knowledge is primary or secondary, essential or extra,
And who gets to decide that, right?
Right? And so I'll just say as a last point, this is why, there's so many places to tackle these issues, but it's why I'm motivated to stay in the context of education where I'm teaching, for example, a class that's cross-listed with engineering and African-American studies, so that I can get these young people early to show them all of the things that they should be thinking about and questioning before they're in a role in which they're told that's extra, that's not important. I have to show them much earlier how essential this is to their own thinking.
So what is that class? What is that class called?
It's called Black Mirror, Race, Technology, and Justice.
Wow.
So we use the Black Mirror TV show as a springboard to ask questions about how technology is mirroring back to us the issues, the problems that we see in the world, and then what we can do about that, how we can design technologies differently so that they don't reproduce the status quo, but actually help to subvert it. And so in that class, I get students from so many different disciplines and fields, including those going into tech, so that they're kind of armed with the language and the insights that they can be good troublemakers once they take their next step. Oh,
that's amazing. That's amazing. For the summit, our Racial Justice at Work summit, April 23rd through the 25th, you are going to be our closing keynote speaker, and your topic is going to be Utopia, Dystopia, or Estopia, Reckoning with the Future of Technology and Society. So can you give us just a little bit of a brief preview of what we can expect to learn about biased bots, altruistic algorithms, et cetera?
I'd be happy to. And so I'm going to talk about are these two primary stories that we tell and are told about technology. The one is gloom and doom, dystopia. Technology is associated with everything bad. It's taking all the jobs. It's, you know, robbing us of our human agency. It's addictive. And then the other story, which is what Silicon Valley works to sell us, which is everything good is associated with technology. It's going to bring us utopia. It's going to make everything more fair, more efficient. And so I want us to look critically at both of those stories because they share some features in common. And then I want to point us towards an alternative, which is not the extremes of utopia or dystopia, but utopia is a way to talk about the fact that the future is us. That is, whatever we're doing now, we're going to do more of it for good or bad. And so it invites us to reclaim our power and our agency with respect to these technical systems. And rather than sort of giving up, throwing up our hands and saying, well, it's all good or all bad, when in fact, it's a middle way that I think we have to reckon with.
So one thing, so tell us one thing that is good about technology for historically oppressed and marginalized people.
Well, when it comes to social media in particular, it often helps us create or maintain communities and connect with people who we might be disconnected from. Like you're having an experience, let's say, in your workplace. You're the only Black woman in your team. But through these tools, you can actually figure out, oh, the problem is not me. The problem is you all, because you realize that there's other people having that experience in other organizations and companies. And so it can be this tool to help you connect and thereby try to create these critical masses to change whatever you're experiencing. And so that what some colleagues of mine call it hashtag activism, the way that these tools can help connect us and as a starting point to make changes.
Right. And give me one thing that is bad about technology specifically. Well, we know there's so many, but one specific thing, like your biggest sort of your biggest frustration with technology.
One of the things, especially when it comes to the introduction of AI into many of our workplaces and systems, is the mythology around it. So we assume that it's magical. We assume that it is actually artificial when it's not, because there's masses of humans behind the screen that are doing the click work that make these tools seem automatic and seem magical. So for me, the key is to really pull back the screen so that we can see the exploitative work conditions and the ecological costs. That is the fact that to power any given algorithm or to train an algorithm, there's masses of energy, minerals, you know, planetary costs associated with it. And so it's really understanding what's behind these tools and not necessarily—
Is that the black box you speak about?
You can include that definitely in the black box, opening that black box so it's not so mystical. So that because to do that, that means that we can start to question it and redesign it. But as long as things stay black boxed, they stay removed from us and we feel like we have less power to question, thereby change it. And so I think that's definitely a first step to deal with these harmful tools.
Because to think that technology is race neutral when, like you were saying, the people who are developing it are not neutral because we live in a racialized world. So we're not saying that the people who are developing are necessarily racist, but we're just saying we live in a racialized world where we've been programmed.
Exactly. And so part of it is like, you know, people want to, they think that just because someone didn't intend to be harmful, in their development of a particular technology, that that is an alibi. Like, okay, then we don't get to worry about it. But it doesn't require the explicit intent to do harm. Mm-hmm. It just requires that people are not thinking or questioning the social dimensions of whatever they're developing, that they assume that they have it all figured out. So they have many blind spots in the process. And so it's, again, that hubris, that kind of know-it-all culture. Some people call it like tech bro culture, where you assume that you don't need to consult anyone else. You don't need to include other folks in your thought process.
It's an arrogance, right? This is sort of an arrogance that goes along with that. So this wasn't on my list of questions, but I'm curious in terms of what's happening in our politics today and the polling and the influence that technology is having on political discourse and outcomes.
I mean, many of the people who have been using these digital tools to spread disinformation, to collect data and weaponize it, you know, going back to the Trump's election, to the Brexit referendum in the UK, along with, the elections in many other countries, have been very explicit that they are using these tools in order to, in their words, you know, Steve Bannon said, we want to break society so that we can rebuild it in our image. Yes. You know? And so they're not sugarcoating it or being subtle. And so once you realize, oh, these tools are being deployed and weaponized in order to create greater fractions and to create greater division and inequities, we can just start, use their words. You know, this is the ethos that's being used to shape these tools. And so that automatically tells us they're not neutral, they're not objective, they're being used to break this social fabric apart. And so what I really want us to do is to be as emboldened as they are in order to build society. If they're working to break it, what are we doing to build it, to strengthen the social fabric, to create a stronger social safety net? And in some cases, using technology to do that. But in other cases, we're talking about old school kind of like social connections and knowing our neighbors and, you know, being in community with people who live in our actual physical world, not just online and virtually. And so, I mean, part of it is to really understand that this is important work, that there are forces working actively to do the opposite. And so we have to organize and we have to build power in order to create the kind of social fabric that is actually livable, that we would all benefit from.
Now that is just amazing. And I think this is a good place for us to end. And that is why we're putting on, Justice for All, our 3-day virtual summit celebrating our 40th anniversary, because we do believe that there is still hope. We do believe that there are ways to build those connections. And I think what you're saying is what we've been saying too, our voice has to be louder than the voices that are trying to tear apart democracy, that are trying to tear apart the work around diversity, equity, and inclusion, because many of these folks don't even know what it is.
No.
They assume that it's all about race, and anything that is about race, they want to, tear down. But to your point earlier about, the sum of us, they don't realize that if you're tearing down DEI programs, you're tearing down programs that support people with disabilities, that support the LGBTQIA, that support gender, that support people who are neurodiverse. I mean, all of this is a part of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But those who are weaponizing it truly think that it's about Black people getting something that they don't think that they deserve. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you so very much for this time. And we look forward to having you in April for our summit. And I appreciate all that you're doing. All the best on your new book, because you do have another book that you're working on, right? Imagination.
Yeah, it'll be out in a few weeks. So I might.
It's going to be out in a few weeks.
Yeah, you might hear a little bit about that in April.
That will be great. We would love to hear about that. So I'm glad that I lifted that up as well. So until next time, we will say goodbye to our guests and continue to fight for equity and justice in our world. That's what we're all about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.